cycle jerks.
Hey, get out of the road, dummy.
Cycle Jerks Podcast.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to Cycle Jerks Podcast, episode 135. I'm your host, Mike Stewart, here joined today, as always, by Dave Dalton. Dave, good, how you doing, buddy?
Good morning, everybody. Yeah, I'm doing great. Doing great. Yeah. Well, sort of. I'm still an unemployed loaf, but, you know, otherwise I'm doing great.
Hey, I'm going to talk a lot of shit to Dave about being unemployed and how long he's milking it. But this week we're excited. We have a great bicycle designer joining us from Ibis Bicycles, Roxy Lowe. So we'll talk more with Roxy in a little bit when she joins us. But Dave, yeah, how are you pulling this off being quote unemployed for what is it, months on end now?
It's just a ruse, Mike. I frantically work in the morning, and when Sue comes out of the bedroom, I have all these windows for job opportunities in my resume, and as soon as she leaves, I get on my bike and I go for a ride.
Well, that's something I can respect and understand.
No, I joke. It's a tough thing out there. You know, you read all the stuff about the great job market, and then, you know, you talk to people and they're like, wow, I'm getting ghosted. Like, I submit a resume and no one gets back to me, or I do this and I do that. But
do you think it's because of how old you are? You think that's like playing role on it?
Yeah. I'm not one to make excuses. You know, I don't like, I don't do it. Like, you know, I'm definitely not one, but I think that plays a role for sure.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and it's hard to convince someone if you don't get the interview, it's hard to convince someone that I'm not in this until I'm 65 and start collecting unemployment. Right.
Right.
Or not a Social Security. Right. I'm actually in it for the long haul. But I would also say too, that I'm being a little selective. Like, I have this vision of going to work in the bike industry or for a organization or charity that I've supported in the past, something that has meaning to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when those didn't first materialize, I find myself applying for jobs like in tech again. And you know, I'm writing these cover letters. I go, I don't want this fucking job. You know what I mean? Why am I going through this? So I've kind of rolled back and I've just become a bit more selective. So that's a problem as well too, because I'm just not blasting out resumes. I'm being selective. So
right. We'll see. And what's Sue think of all this with you, you know, on your high horse here, not willing to work as you got to identify with this company on some level?
Wait a second. Well, how many, I got to do this. I got to do the math here. 83. So this is 1983, and we're in 2023, so married 40 some odd years, and I'm truly blessed. And I'm not saying I don't think she really listens to the podcast that often unless I tell her you got to hear this one.
But she gets enough of your rhetoric at home,
she's blessed, and she believes that the age thing is an issue, and she just says that, you know, find something that you like to do, and even if it goes means temporarily going back to substitute teaching until to just abide time. And I think that's the trajectory I'm on. Mm-hmm. Just go back. And that's not a bad gig, by the way, right? The teaching is just a shame that teachers don't get paid more money. And you know that, right?
Yeah.
Stella.
No doubt.
So it's not a bad trajectory. And it'll hopefully keep us, you know, food on the table until something does come along. And I'm just lucky that she's supportive of it.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. All right. Who's our sponsor this week?
Oh, you know, I shuffled them around a little bit, and but I'm back to Phil's Cookies, and I had to do it just simply because I told you last week about making the cookies because Sue was away. I had to do the baking.
Yes.
Well, the reality, and you made a joke about cookies for breakfast.
Yeah.
I had no idea what Snickerdoodle was. I actually bought the wrong one. I bought chocolate and Snickerdoodle. I had no idea what it was. And it's literally cinnamon.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there and Sue said the same thing. She goes, are we eating Cinnabon for breakfast or are we having cookies for a snack? I mean, they're that good. They're absolutely that good. So I highly recommend Phil's cookies. It's absolutely easy to make. I did it, if you can believe that. And $1 from every bag goes to No Kid.
Okay. I might need to look at the accounting on this sponsorship deal because the cookie, are you getting paid? Are we getting paid in cookies?
No, no, what's happening here? I told Dara we were going to talk about her today, but we'll have to do it next week because,
should we be concerned? I mean, how many calories are in these cookies?
I'm really good. They're made. I make the decision to eat them. I eat two. That's it. I won't. The rest of them will just map my son. They'll just go. Or so we'll take them to work or something. I'm done. I ate them. I can attest to the fact that they're delicious.
And these are not, these are just delicious cookies. These are not like a fuel source for on the bike. Like I know Scratch does that thing where they actually have you, they have cookies. You buy this mix and it's like, it's supposed to be like a energy bar.
No. I think Phil likes the good life. I mean, he certainly rides a lot and is very, you could tell he's fit and all that, but he likes his whiskey, likes his cookies.
Yeah.
And they're for a good cause, but no, this is just comfort food.
Yeah. So, okay. All right. So Phil's cookies, check them out.
Phil's cookies. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, so Derek went home.
Yeah. Yeah. So a little update, you know, last week we mentioned, at Dialed Health on Instagram, Derek Teal, Derek, he's just a pillar in the cycling community. He does, like our sponsor, Dara, he does a lot of free content of, stretches and workout routines and, specifically for cyclists. And then he also does, some more intense coaching. So he has a business that he runs and, is an incredible cyclist and athlete. And, you know, he got hit by a car and, was in the hospital and multiple surgeries and, he just got sent home. I think it was yesterday, day before yesterday. And so that was really good to see. And, he's on the recovery path. He's already, he's already working the rubber band.
I know,
you know, but, he's still in pretty rough shape though.
I know, but I think that that's a testament to the kind of shape that he's in and his, I mean, if he can do a double Everest, right, he's got some mind power too. And I think had that willpower to be out of the hospital in 9 days and then be doing that already kind of physical therapy. I mean, man, that's a real testament.
And, you know, there was a big group ride for him. There, our friends over at MTB NorCal put together this charity ride for Derek on Sunday. And a lot of people donated prizes. They had a big raffle and huge turnout. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to go. I'm in the process of building a in-law unit at my house and it's all consuming.
Yeah.
So, I wasn't able to make it out there for that, but, I would have loved to. A lot of my friends from the Sacramento cycling community obviously were there. Derek's, based in Sacramento. So, so I had to live vicariously through everybody else on with the online posting and everything, but it looked like a great day.
I'm going to get on my high horse a little bit here. And, you know, this was a hit and run, right? And to the best of my knowledge, I don't think that they've caught right. So I think, you know, that I do this cycling club, right? Ride for Good and the pedal project and whatnot. And so we're back to the first Sunday of every month. And it's good news is it's not a plug, but the good news is that the turnout's coming back. Like it, you know, it's really the numbers are starting to go up. So I'm super excited about it. But yesterday, and I always give a speech before and tell people to be careful and all that. But yesterday, you know, And I'm not saying this is what happened, right? This hit and run thing. And I know, having known Derek, I'm sure that this isn't what happened, but it goes back to something that Phil Guymon said one time too, mm-hmm. right? Is I told my guys yesterday, I said, you know, do not like it. If something happens out on the road, first of all, just be safe, be a good cycling citizen. But, yeah. you know, someone buzzes you, someone cuts you off, someone, you know, blares their horn in it. You know, don't give them the finger. Don't yell. Don't curse. Cause you just don't know who's in that car. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's what happened, but you know, that's all, there's enough crazy people out there. It's going to take somebody, if somebody's willing to actually, you know, even if it's an accident, right. But like, as you mentioned, but you just don't want to incite something, because if you get hit by a car, right, you don't stand a chance, right? And look what happened to Derek, right? And too many of our friends have been hurt that way. And it's such a hard thing to do. But, you know, I was on a ride, truthfully, on Saturday, where we did all the right thing and some car kind of rolled through a stop sign. And it was just an accident, right? Mm-hmm. But a couple of the people in our group start yelling at the guy in the car. It's like, no, don't do this, you know? Right. So
right,
it's a tough thing, but you know, as Phil Guymon said, I think on our podcast or in one of his videos, is just don't engage. You just don't know what's going to happen. So
yeah,
just
that's great advice. You know, there's you see so much wild stuff. I feel like you know, like social media, it's normalizing on some level like this chaos, right? Maybe it's just my feed. But I have like dash cam and I got all these different feeds that have like these terrible things that are happening to people on a pretty regular basis. And it's, I feel like, you know, to my point, I feel like it's kind of normalized, at least with certain sector of people that maybe would be vulnerable to behaving in this way, you know?
Yeah.
You don't want to be the cause of somebody's meltdown, you know? Yeah. You very well could be, just because you're riding your bike and you're in Lycra and you know, you're out there doing your thing. That could be enough to incite somebody. But you know, certainly giving somebody the finger or yelling at them or something, I mean, at that point, you're kind of asking for it, you know? Yeah. So yeah,
you want to, right?
We all have that feeling. Yeah. Yeah, but you have to take the high road, you know. You can't dip like that, you know.
And it's an interesting plug for one of our upcoming pods when we talk to Chris and Matt about their cross country trip.
Yes.
But I'm curious. I mean, that was 2012, right?
Yeah.
And you know how they were saying, oh my God, you know, we only had, the whole time we're out on the road, we only had one incident somewhere in Nevada where some guy kind of faked that he was going to pull out in front of him. And he said, other than that, everyone out on the road. I'm very curious, you know, 12 years later, if that would be the same out on the road. I just think so much has changed.
Well, certainly the distracted driving is at a whole nother level.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, for sure. So,
yeah. But I'd be curious. I'd be curious to see.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike, I'm just going to say it, so you might as well do it now. We screwed up again. We didn't introduce our guest before we started yabbering.
No, we did. We did. We did. Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Oh, that's a sign of my age.
You're getting old, Dave. Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember anything. Yeah. We're very excited to have our next guest on. Roxy is Roxy Lowe. She's a principal designer at Ibis Bicycles, making some of the most beautiful mountain bike designs in our industry, and also one of the five principal partners that own Ibis. So Roxy, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Oh man, this is, I got your little resume there and I'm like, wow. So I said in my email, we're going to have to extend this thing out to about 3 hours to get all the get all my questions answered.
Yeah.
We'll just take it offline and ride or something.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So welcome. You had a bad patch of weather, right? You were offline.
Yeah, we have a little, electric battery, set of batteries and generator at the house. So we, since COVID, we actually set ourselves up for success. Like we have a extender for our cell phone boost, so we still get 100% Wi-Fi with streaming. And yeah, with my ham radio, I can pretty much hear everything. So
yeah.
And now you're in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, up in the mountains.
Okay, so this is you have to almost be prepared because it's a pretty regular occurrence down there, right?
Or unfortunately, up there, I should say. Yes. last year we got snowed in, which was a first. That was pretty crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy. Wow. For sure. Well, Roxy, where are you from originally?
I'm from the Bay Area. I grew up in Alameda, actually.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so when did you first discover the bicycle? And
oh, the first discovered one? Yeah. You mean the banana?
Not the first time you invented one, but the first time you.
Yeah.
I didn't actually get into mountain biking until my mid-20s after I had started my career in design. And, you know, I had gone through a rough patch of, I moved to San Francisco for work and for school. And then I actually went down with the dot-com boom, the first one. And before I actually got laid off, I was like, you know, this is like a sinking ship. I wanna expand my horizons. And so I ended up moving to Hong Kong, becoming a marketing manager for a ceramics and glassware company, because I felt like I would learn a lot about mold making and production in China. And I kind of knew that's where everything was heading at that time. But I got so disenchanted when I moved there because all I was doing was going to factories and seeing just mass production of like these goods, and for very low prices, almost like people losing their entire culture base just to make, you know, like snow globes and you know, blow up tents and stuff. So yeah, it was a little bit frustrating. And I actually came back home after 9/11, and I decided, like, I was just so disenchanted and so bummed out about the state of manufacturing that I really reassessed what I was doing as a product designer, because as a product designer, you're making stuff all the time. And so that's when I sort of started thinking, like, what industry could I still use my design talents for, but still feel like I was being a part of something better, you know, bettering myself or bettering my friends and family by, like, you know, being outdoors. So like the outdoor industry was really a big draw for me, because I had spent so much time in tech and, you know, sitting in an office. And, you know, I suddenly got into cycling at that time. I had an idea of coming to Santa Cruz to enjoy the outdoors. And I borrowed a Heckler, I think, a Santa Cruz Heckler. And I rode this like aluminum 35-pound bike. And I was just like in love. I was in love with the outdoors. I was in love with the speed. I really enjoyed the fact that I needed to gear up. So I really liked putting on all these like clothes and products and things to help me move through space on a bike. And I was just like in my happy space.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was the love of bikes, but you know, that you didn't ask me where my career started. So that's where I fell in love with bikes.
Yeah. Well, I could see where, you know, many people have probably fallen in love with riding in Santa Cruz as well. You know, anybody that it is kind of Mecca in a way for trail riding. And at one point it was even the center of the dirt jumping scene, you know, in Abtos, for years they had the famous post office. Yeah. And some of the world's best mountain bikers have come from Santa Cruz. So, and a lot of that's just because of the terrific terrain and the riding that's there and the culture. Yeah, it's Santa Cruz is really a special place. And Yeah, so that's great that you've managed to work your way down there and create a life for yourself. Now, prior to working on bicycles, you mentioned product designer. What types of industries were you designing products for? Was it a specific industry, or was it more just industrial design for multiple industries?
My first two jobs, I want to say, were working for Pottery Barn as a designer in housewares and accessories, like so furniture, accessories, things that you would buy to revamp your bathroom or your kids' space. I worked for Pottery Barn Kids for a while. I worked for a lot of the different brands within Williams-Sonoma, and for the kids group, that was pretty fun because I got to work on stuffed animals. I got to work on dollhouses. It was just great. And then I actually, turned down a full-time position there because I wanted to join a consultancy. And so in the consultancy, I was working on, like blue sky projects for, like outdoor grilling companies and housewares and, computers, Samsungs, cell phones, like everything under the sun that you can imagine product designs needing. I was doing a lot of user research and interface with customers and trying to verify like these brand new ideas and kind of coming up with all those fun things that the actual people that work there can't do because they're so busy doing other things. Like we were like the blue sky company that would come in and dream up stuff. And so I felt like I had a huge swath of information about like how do you design, not only design and manufacture something, but why you want to do that and like what problems are you trying to solve? And like how you relate with your products is really important. I think that I worked so much on handheld items that ergonomics and my sensibilities, you can't just be aesthetic. You have to actually like put things in your hands and see if they feel good, if they work right. One of the things as a product designer you almost want to solve is like, can I do that with my eyes closed, with my non-dominant hand, and like the other hand behind me or something? So you're really trying to use your sensibility, trying to understand the product and the person using it.
Eyes closed, and is that where the eyes closed and one hand behind you? That's not about bikes, right? That's about
That's about everything.
the Is
Can
that
you
where
think?
the
Yeah, can you touch something and like understand how you're supposed to use it? And it was really funny because the cycling industry was probably the hardest industry to understand because of all the nomenclature, all the peripheral products, and like I kind of watch the evolution of things like dropper posts and like all these like different gearing, and now that they're becoming electric, it's like coming back to like full circle. Like I'm like, oh, I understand electric stuff. Like there's a computer in it. Okay, cool. Like so it's a really interesting dynamic when you're trying to relearn the entire vocabulary of a product's existence. So yeah, that was pretty crazy.
I jumped ahead though, but when did the burnout in tech happen? Having burned out in tech, right? As I'm sure a lot of our listeners will also say that, and whether it be tech, we're slamming tech, but you could be an accountant or you could be a teacher or whatever, and at some point you just said there's got to be something else. Like, so that's a bold move, right? Is to something that even if it's .com and it's forced upon you, let's face it, it's the tech pays well to, but to pick up and walk away to go do something that you might be more passionate about, it's a big deal, right?
Yeah, and I think there was a little of that in a mass exodus of people leaving their jobs post-COVID. It's like, do I really have to be in a space for X amount of hours a day? And I think my first like aha moment for that was like, I think I had a deadline, and I remember staring at the lights underneath my desk because I was sleeping on the floor. I had to
Wow.
take a break, but I was like, you know, the hum of that computer is really bothering me right now. And I was just like, I am still at work. Like, this is really
Yeah.
bad. You know,
Wow.
and you know, that's not being like not passionate about your job. It's about like, you know, setting boundaries and having some kind of balance of life and work.
I want to, we obviously want to get to bikes, but I think that if there's anything that good that did come out of COVID, right, other than more people got on bikes and whatnot, I hope that, you know, I hope that that is a lesson learned, that people found that there is something on the other side that's, you know, whether they're still in their same job, but they get to do it from a different location or work less hours. I just hope that I hope that it sticks. Let's put it that way. So.
A couple weekends ago I went to a all clubs gala. This is like a little this it's in its third year, and it's a club event based out of Long Beach, California. And the club originally started as like a all black clubs gathering, and that started 3 years ago, and that wasn't a mistake because in like within like 19 or 2019, all these people started riding bikes online, you know, on their trainers and in person. And suddenly there was like this resurgence of new bike clubs. I mean, I was looking at some of the bike club members and looking at their websites, and they were like so fundamentally like on point with like, oh, we've got a chapter in this city, in this state, in this city. And it was like, wow, this started only 3 years ago or 2 years ago, and they've just run with it. And so there are a lot of people that kind of embrace the virtual and the real world and made communities. And I really think that that's indicative of like what we can do as cyclists, because you know, we're all kind of like in our own spaces, but like we're a part of a bigger culture here.
For sure.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, well said.
So, Roxy, how long have you been with IBIS?
Since they restarted IBIS 2.0 in 2003, officially 2005. So
Okay.
we started I've been there for a while now. I did continue consulting for other companies until I ended up moving to Santa Cruz because I was still living in San Francisco and designing. But I made the big move to Santa Cruz like in 2009, and you know that's when I kind of decided like all my eggs in
Yeah.
the
Is that when you
basket.
became one of the partners or
The partners was early on in 2005.
Oh, okay.
You know, yeah, I was freelancing, and then we ran out of money to pay me, so then I worked for shares. Yeah, it was very cute. I remember thinking like, oh, do you think this is gonna actually like pan out to something? Or are we just gonna make like one bike, go to Interbike, and then go home, you know?
Right.
So.
Wow. I'm interested in what would keep you hooked on something like that, right? I mean, when, you know, there's no money coming in, but there's this promise of shares, right? But and this will come out wrong, but like, why did IBIS hire you? Like, when did you make that transition from I love riding a heckler to you should bring me on because I know how to design bikes, right? So
Oh, I didn't profess to know how to design bikes at all. I think I was like, I don't know what y'all are doing. You know, this is so foreign to me. And you know, when I first got into like the world of people in cycling, I remember I sent a resume to Santa Cruz Bikes because they just acquired Swobo at the moment.
I remember.
And you know, I I'm pretty practical. So I was like, well, I've done soft goods, I've done some bags, I've done stuffed animals, like how hard can clothing be in there?
Underwater cameras.
Right, yes, I did do underwater cameras and lighting as well. Actually, I didn't get into that until after Cycling Space because cycling opened all the doors for outdoor for me. They were like, oh, you can design a bike? Okay, what about like a light that goes on your bike? I'm like, sweet, yes, I can do that. But I sent my resume to Santa Cruz Bikes, and at that time, Hans Heim was one of the partners, but he ended up getting bought out. And he kept my resume in the back of his head. And so he had a 2-year non-compete. And he was like, I don't know if you want to, try out a project with me, but I have this, little business card project with my friend's shop here in Santa Cruz. Would you mind trying to make a business card? And I was like, huh, I'm not a graphic designer, but I've made my own business card. I know how to use like Illustrator and Photoshop. I know how to use the software. I was completely like oblivious to like how much time it would take to make a business card. I did that, and then he was like, well, I was kind of doing this to see how we would work together and how your process was. I'd really be interested in knowing if you'd like to design a bike. And I want to make this bike out of carbon fiber. Other people in the industry right now haven't fully embraced it. They were still like full on hydroforming aluminum. And so for him, he was like, I want to make something really stand out with this material. And for me, it was interesting because one, all of the things that I thought I knew about bikes and like the geometry and things like that, it kind of like it didn't, none of it mattered. It was all about the material, the carbon fiber, what it could do, and how it was, how its manufacturing process is. And I used all of my like, synapses for all the other things I've made in my life to kind of like blend soft and hard molding capabilities and like fabric. And somehow it all culminated into this, magical little bicycle. And so, yeah, that was the start of that. And, I was working hourly, for Hans, and he was like, I'm starting to, kind of see like we need to put our money into like getting the engineering done and, all this other stuff. So would you mind working for shares and, being a part of this and kind of like putting a bet in, like we're betting on you, you're betting on us. And I thought that was pretty fair. I come from that kind of world where you're just starting up with like nothing and just ideas. And so it wasn't that far-fetched for me to kind of like really go for it. Although I did have a full-time job on the side because I was like, still gotta pay the bills.
What were you doing on the side?
I was working at that time. That was after I came back from Hong Kong, and I was working full time at Pottery Barn because I definitely needed medical to deal with all the trauma I had from manufacturing. So it was a little bit of a necessary evil, but yeah, I really liked the people that worked there. It was like working in Santa's workshop. Everyone was so kind, so good. And I learned a lot because everyone's a creative there. It was just a magical place to work.
Wow, great. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm curious about the carbon production. So you have Hans, right? He's saying, I want to work with this material. You design it. Were you working with somebody locally that could actually execute your design, or did you have to go overseas for that? Because, I know there was some carbon production. There was Kestrel out of Watsonville, and there was some U.S. Carbon production back then, but most of it, I mean, nowadays it's a lot of it's overseas. What, how'd you get it made initially?
That was all Hans. And I think what I was trying to do here, I was trying to find carbon makers of even small products. Like, I think I ended up finding someone who made kayaks in Pacifica.
Okay.
And I just introduced myself and I was like, I just want to see what this is all about. Like, I had never made carbon fiber anything. You know, watching him like paste up a wet layup of carbon, I was like, wow, this is pretty ridiculous. It's like a giant paper mache.
Yeah.
I was just like, okay, that's interesting. And I, you know, like that was a totally different process than, you know, like needing to mold something from the inside out, like you're pressurizing something from the inside and making it blow up. And and from the outside in, you're kind of trying to keep it from like expanding too much to hold the shapes. So all of those things sort of like informed me when I learned what the process was. But honestly, like I did not see any of that kind of magic up front. So I was like coming at it from a completely novice, just naive standpoint, and just assuming things from like what I understood of mold making. And so, yeah, that was interesting because there wasn't a lot of people making the rear triangles out of carbon fiber yet. So the front triangle was a little bit easier with like one piece, but the swing arms having two sides that have to actually be cast separately and then bonded together, that was a challenge, and definitely mechanically too. So people, you know, I mean, we don't want to explode our bikes when we ride them. So that was one of those challenges where, you know, you had to get it right. And it took a lot of time and energy to do that.
Yeah.
I'm curious about something, and I may have misunderstood, but you said something, it was more about the material and what it could do than the geometry or, and I'm trying to think, here you are in the forefront of creating a small bike, right? That will fit your stature. But it, to me, it's all about, it's almost a reverse in my simple brain that it's just got to be practical and people yes. got to be able to ride it than the material. So,
yeah, you're right. The geometry is there, like underlaying everything. But I think what I was trying to get at was like, because carbon fiber can be like laid up a little bit extra in some areas, or using the weave, you can kind of align it in a pattern that's going to be strengthened. Like it was sort of like the members could go a little bit off this way or a little bit off this way without following like the strict tubular geometry look. But you're absolutely right. The geometry is key, especially for suspension and kinematics. You really want to dial those in so that the riding qualities feel good. You know, I remember one time I rode our Ripmo. It's our 29er. That's kind of like a little bit more full suspension. And I remember riding it in lockout position. And I came back and I was like, oh, that was really nice, you know, and like, but I felt a little bit like harsh on the, you know, like the small bump compliance. And then I looked down and someone else said like, you know, you're completely locked out. And I was like,
whoops.
Okay, let me try again, you know? Yeah. And so the next day I like, you know, unlocked it and rode again. And I felt the same and I had the same, like, you know, the same suspension. And I realized that I wasn't actually utilizing any of the suspension because of my weight. And I had gone under the minimum of, you know, like the 120 or 130, you know, mark.
Yep.
And I was like, okay, so what else is wrong? And so one of the things that I figured out with my engineers was, you know, like I got on, you know, we ship from Ibis. So we have these little scales that you put boxes on to see how much they weigh. So we put two scales down and I put both my wheels, one on the other, and I got on the bike. And I remember there was a misbalance of weight on the frame on the two scales. And I just remember thinking like, oh, that's interesting. I'm not fully planted, you know, like maybe that's why I'm leaning back too much, or like, you know. And we then realized, like, okay, the head angles and the seat tube angles, like, they need to be different for each size frame because you're getting your center of gravity all over the place when you just expect something to be consistent through everything. And your weight rider distribution is going to be different when you're smaller, and like the smaller geo of the frame is going to affect it. So, like learning things like that and the little nuances and like refining those things only comes when you're just really dissecting and having multiple people ride different bikes. Like, I think we have me, who's 5'1", and Tom Morgan, who's like 6'5", 6'6". Like, it's important for us to each have a voice, or else, you really don't know what's going on with those either end people. And like, sometimes even the middle people, they're like, I'm tall, but I have a shorter inseam, like the standover is horrible or something. So all these things came into play because of my background in, pure product development and understanding human dynamics and ergonomics. Like, this is what we have to do to really tailor it to our customers.
So you're so now you're you, we're gonna come back to geometry because I'm all about that, but I'm curious to keep the timeline going here. So now you're working for stock, or you're working for free essentially, but you're betting big on Ibis. At what point did you know this is what was the breakthrough moment that either you had a product that just took off, or you just were still far from product, but I know that we're on the right track?
I feel like, when I moved, when we decided to move in 2009, I felt like we had hit the like 5, 4 year mark of the brand in existence. And to me, that's a good amount of time to like do or die kind of situation with any company. And so, I was working, I was freelancing with Ibis, so I was getting some money from them. I was freelancing at the time with Light in Motion and freelancing with Camelback.
Camelback.
And so I remember one day riding around in Berkeley Hills that I saw someone with like a Mojo with a Light in Motion light wearing a backpack, and I was like, oh, this is wonderful. Like, everything on this guy is like something I made. And I almost like literally like took him down, like, hey, can I get a photo of you? And for me, I think I started getting really involved with the companies I was working with. Not so much Camelback, because they were just employing me for like creating a line of packs. But for Light in Motion, I designed like their whole line 1 year, and some of it is legacy that they have now too. So it was like, starting to work a lot for them and helping them, like cultivate their entire brand. And I was like, you know what? I have this with Ibis. Like, I can control all of this with Ibis if I can work with them full time. And I think a little bit too, they didn't have enough work for me. So I was like, I'll do anything you want. Like, I'll just kind of come in and do what it takes to get this business really going, and help with whatever you need me to do, because I feel strongly that this is important to me. I really love the product. We're doing things differently. I think we hadn't started investing in reshoring our projects yet, but like, I love the fact that we didn't make like year-based product. We finished our products, we designed them, and we kept doing more tweaks until we felt it was ready. We didn't say like, oh, this model year must be, due at this time or date. And I felt that really aligned with my personal need to like not just develop, junk. And not saying like yearly models could be junk, but like the necessary time and involvement and people man hours it takes to get something really different or unique happening, with the amount of people that we had like it just takes time.
Yeah.
And so I just felt like that was the moment where I was like, okay, I'm gonna jump in. And I ended up like helping create our first, you know, B2B portal to sell to dealers. That was really a you know, mind meld for me. Like getting back into that space. You know, and like I, you know, right now I stock the vending machine, I do a bunch of different stuff. I, you know, things that
whatever
I like doing,
takes.
But you know, whatever it takes. I think it's, and it's good because I feel like, you know, when you're involved in everything and you don't have a like a so much of a hierarchy, you really can empathize and sympathize with everyone on every level. Like you just don't, you're not like, oh, I'm gonna just like give that task to you because it's beneath me or something. It's like, no, I'm gonna do it because it's satisfying. Other people do it and we all need to find the satisfaction somehow.
Yeah, on a personal note, it's funny you say that. Mike and I were talking before, so I'm currently unemployed. And I believe that one of the things that I've struggled with is that, you know, I've had these titles of VP of marketing or director and all this. And to the point being is that, you know, now you go and you apply for this individual contributor role, which I'm very happy to do because for a lot of reasons, but people will say, well, but you used to be a VP. I said, yeah, but I owned a bike shop. And when I owned that bike shop, I could have told anyone to clean the bathroom, but I chose to clean the bathroom, right? You know what I mean? It's like all hands on deck. You do whatever it takes to get the job done, to make the place look good, and to make sure your customers are happy, right? And so I try to convey that message that like, I'm willing to do anything, stock the vending machine, you know, you just tell me what you need done and I'll get it done. So
yeah,
I applaud you for that's your mindset and that it continues. So kudos.
Yeah. Well, and so I kind of want to get into the, you know, at IBIS, you have an all-female design team, as I understand it, right? Mm-hmm. And so was that something that was that intentional or did it just kind of happen organically?
Yeah. We don't need to tell you that's fairly unique in the industry, right?
Yeah.
Yes. You know, and I would say that, you know, after talking to a couple of other leadership, you know, managers in different companies, it's hard to do unless you're trying to do it and you're doing outreach. And to be really honest, like people that are engineers or people in the creative space, like bike isn't one of those like standout industries, you know, that goes and does outreach into schools or, you know, places like that. It's like you have to love bike to be in bike, or like you have to know about bikes to be in bikes. But bike industry needs a lot more people now. Like, you know, they need electrical engineers, or they need, you know, creative, like, you know, colorists or stuff like that. And so I feel like when we talk about trying to make the space equal in gender and equal in diversity, like there's not a lot of that happening just because of how small and niche cycling is compared to like shoes, you know, like everyone has a shoe, but like not everyone has a mountain bike.
Right.
And so we've relied heavily on people that are already, you know, really interested in cycling and really interested in bike. But I know other brands, you know, like they have such a prolific amount of, you know, stuff to be designed. Like we have frames only mostly, but there's other companies that do accessories and like pumps and like saddles. And so, you know, traditionally in the ID world, in the industrial design world, there's a lot of women that migrate to things that are not as technically driven as well. So like housewares or fashion or, you know, products like in the home or something like that. And it's so gendered, I have to say. It's like, it's completely gendered. And mm-hmm. whenever I talk with schools or I'm introduced to like, you know, do critiques or something during design reviews for design schools, you know, I'm always struck by, like, you know, how gendered people's design directions go. And one, it's something that you're like, I want to be successful and I want to have, I want to attain this job or this career path. And you do what you love and what you know. So, like, if you've never ridden a bike or you've never gone in that space, like, how would you know that you could do it? And so, long story short, like, I think when we have women or women identifying come into cycling space, are they seeing other people like them? Are they seeing opportunities where they can grow into upper management? Are they seeing themselves represented? Like, if I design a bike, am I gonna see on our website it's only guys riding, you know? Or, you know, is there a woman riding that? And, like,
yeah,
I want other people to know. And still it's hard, like, even it's still hard to kind of pound that drum and saying, like, no, we really are in this space. Our two current designers, Lily Heim and Catherine, she goes by Kat, they're both really interested in designing their with their own passions in mind. So, like, Lily is really great at color and graphics and just making sure things match and have the same aesthetic, whereas Kat is, like, really technically minded, and she's, like, all about, like, making things as thin as possible, whereas I'm really interested in making something kind of identify with the rider and be as artistic and, you know, elegant as I can make it, and also demystify, like, the product itself. So, you know, I think we all come at things from different perspectives, and there's a place for everyone with that. And so I think that's where we need to start kind of showcasing the fact that not only are we women necessarily, but that we come at it from a creative standpoint, and it's not purely technical, but there can be, you know, so many variations of that technicality. And it's all about, like, the professionalism, right? So you just want to work with people that you can have a shared conversation with and enjoy being with. Do what you love and love who you're doing it with.
Yeah. Yeah. I was looking on the website, and I know Scott Nickel, the founder, is still with the company. And that's one of his, I don't know if you want to call it, criteria, you know, is to do what you love and to do it with people that you really care about. Mm-hmm. And he still feels like he's getting that to this day. So that's really cool. But if I could just give you a little story about industrial designer, where it really hit me for the first time, right? So I work for Giant Bicycles. I've been with the company for 22 years now, and grew up in the bike business. But I remember I went to a presentation, and it was Eric Clem, who is a lead designer at Giant, and he was talking about the new road bike that they're going to bring to market. And behind him was a wolf. It was like this, you know, it was a wolf. And he starts talking about the cyclists and, you know, that sometimes you ride in packs, sometimes you're the lone wolf, you know, but he got more into the form of the wolf. And that was the design inspiration to the new TCR that year. And so if you would just looked at the TCR with the way it was made and the graphics or whatever on it, there's no way that my mind would ever go to wolf. But after listening to his presentation, you could totally see all these elements of the wolf in the design of the bike. And I just remember, you know, I worked for GT for 5 years. I worked for Cannondale, but that presentation was so impactful to me. And it made me realize, like, just how different somebody that is in industrial design looks at the world, because I would have never drew a correlation. And I was just so impressed by the, the way that he presented it, and then was able to put it into a bike. And it was, so I have, ever since then, I'm always curious, like, talk to me about the industrial design. I want to find more, you know, I want to know more.
Where's the inspiration come from?
Yeah. So it must be really fun to work in that space where you can, it's just, you're tapping into this creativity. And
yeah, it's interesting because, you know, everyone has a different thing, you know, that's pretty cool. Like wolf, a lot of people think birds. I often do like birds. I think birds a lot. I met someone from Shimano, and he thinks about whale bones, you know, like it's just crazy. Like, I mean, but it's interesting when you hear that and then you can sort of start seeing, or you can start imagining where those are coming from. And then all of a sudden you're like, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I think a lot about chocolate chip cookies. Where would that get me in the bike industry?
Probably like in frame storage.
There you go, in frame storage.
I'm sorry, but a question, and I want to stick on the design thing. Now, this I'm going to show you come out wrong, but you would probably hear with a lot of women's products that they have to be designed for women because men don't understand the women, the nuances. And, you know, so it's a potentially, how am I saying that? Right. Do men fully understand what women want or whatever? I'm just saying that that's things I've heard in the past. Now, how does an all women's design team fully understand what men want? And I applaud this. It's all great, but I'm just curious as to, you know, I think there's a reason why there's women's specific shoes. At some point someone said, you know, a men's running shoe isn't the same as a women's running shoe, right? So is this making any sense? Is that
I don't know enough about shoes
to
go there, but you know, honestly, I feel like there's a legacy of human ergonomics that has been around with us since, like, okay, I don't know, the mid 60s or something. And there's a lot of like average heights and average this, and, you know, and I'm like, bodies are totally different, mm-hmm, for everybody. Yep. And, you know, I think of bikes as machines off the bat, like, but it's like when you go to a store and you buy off the rack, you're never gonna have like a tailor-made suit or a tailored dress that fits you perfectly.
Right.
You can get pretty close, and I think that's where everyone is fighting right now, in that space of like geometry and heights and like where standover is and where length of reach is. Like, it's so important, you know, like that it can really make or break your body. I mean, the fact that, you know, we have to get fitted when we ride bikes or else we get really injured or have like long sustaining injuries. Like, you know, those are the important things that we have to consider. Not so much, I think, male or female, but like, just the nuances that make all of our proportions different and making products work for us. Like, I remember I was at Sea Otter and I was at SQL Labs or something, and I was like, oh, they have these squishy seats and I can sit on it and it measures my sit bones. And so I sat down on it and another guy just kind of stood up and sat down next to me, and he was like maybe 6 inches taller than me and like, you know, super skinny, and he sits on it and I was like, oh my God, we have the same sit bones. Like, that's interesting, you know, like,
right.
And so like, I don't think it's necessarily like wrong for companies to position, you know, a women's or a men's product, because we've been marketed that way for so long that it's really, really hard to ungender everything. So it's almost simpler to be like, okay, that's a woman's saddle. because you can buy it. Because
Yeah.
we have bikes, and I don't, and we don't say like they're women's specific or men's specific, but like literally women will not buy it because they're like, well, that's not a women's bike. And I'm like, oh my God, like I just made a bike. Like it's not either gender. But because like it's such a strong marketing understanding of like what women have versus what men have. This is different though for like clothing. You know, our bodies are generally different.
Yeah.
Shoulders and widths and heights and stuff. But like to break it all down, you know, I think that's where the fashion industry is really pushing it right now, because they're making sizing from like negative, you know, like extra 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 smalls to, you know, extra 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 larges, because we all know that our bodies come in different sizes and it's not necessarily gendered to fit different body proportions either. So I think there's a huge kind of paradigm shift right now for what is men's versus what is women's. But there are products, there are specialty products that really do make a difference. And I'm totally generalizing here. But in what I understand of like what I've made and what we've determined for Ibis is, you know, like this is how we create things, and we do things with the lowest standover possible that can accommodate the most lowest inseams of our average bicycle rider that comes to our demos. Like we do research. We're like, okay, what's your height and what's your inseam, so we understand ratios. My height could be the same as someone else, but our inseam height length might be totally different. And so yeah, I think it's important to kind of look deeper into those questions.
Yeah, you
You said
know,
something.
oh, go
Oh, go
ahead,
ahead,
Dave.
Mike. Oh, I was going to say when I was in retail, it was a long time ago, and fitting someone was in its early stages, you know, whereas now it's evolved into a much more developed concept. But in the early stage, but so we had this thing from the New England Cycling Academy. It came in a wooden box, and there was a picture I remember that had all these people lined up against a wall, and they were all 5'9". And it drew a line on the waist of each person, you know? And so you really got a sense of, wow, you know, here's all these people, exact same size, and I think there were nine of them. They all had different inseams, different torso lengths, and so that was really where it kind of hit me. You know, how to, you know, when these manufacturers have these sizing ranges, it's like, oh, you should be a medium. It's like, no, it's not that simple. You know, we really need to dig a little bit deeper here to find out what the proportions are. And yeah, so that was kind of like my first, you know, beginning to it. But when you factor in to full suspension and you know, men versus women, you know, obviously I work for a brand that has a dedicated women's lineup, and one of the appeals to the Live full suspension mountain bikes is that for a retailer is that it's going to come most likely set up to where you're going to be able to set up the rider with less changes, right? Whereas if it's a universal bike, you know, and you may have to change some things around to get the fit properly. Whereas more often than not, we're going to be closer to the mark with a Live product when fitting a woman. And this really comes into play with shock tuning and you know, that part of it with a mountain bike. So you know, and I know you've been an advocate in your career for, you know, bikes for smaller riders and bikes for women. So how do you juxtapose like the accomplishing that, but then also with the stock shock tuning that the companies make, or does Ibis do anything like that?
I would say like, you know, like, especially with some of our mixed wheel sizes, you know, like if it comes off the bat, you know, size small comes with a 27.5 back versus 29 for both. Some things will just be more fun and playful to ride with overall. You know, like crank lengths is important. You know, you don't want to run like the 170s for a size small. You're going to rock strike all the time. And, you know, it's interesting because like, we're also dealing with trends in the industry of like, oh yeah, I only run short stems, you know, and it's really funny because you're like, this is just an aesthetic choice or like a choice that you've made because you're like, I don't want some, you know, dangling participle out there. And so like there's certain trends that people want to see happen. And so like, you know, I've always heard people like complain like, oh, the bike industry is making us do this or like it's forcing us into this. And I was like, we are listening to y'all, you know, we're actually catering to some of those opinions. And maybe, you know, like we should stop doing all of it. You know, some of it makes sense. But yeah, like I think having something closer to not is important. And when we work with our suspension partners, you know, there's riders that are like heavier weighted, same height as the slighter weighted riders. And, you know, it's just, it's the same thing. It's like, who's there, who's representing, and who's getting the tunes, you know, like who's actually riding going like, oh, I want this tune to be set up more like this. And so, you know, if the funnel is getting tighter with the amount of people getting suspension tested and like tuned for, you're going to have a tighter set of parameters, right? So you don't have the swath of people. And so you're also educating the customer, like, these are the tunes that we like with our bikes where we're testing it. And so for everyone, you know, it's not just drive the truck off the lot. It's like, how do you, you know, like make it your own and try it a little bit. But, you know, those are all very, very big nuances. And, you know, some of our customers are in that world and can understand all of that. And then for the other ones, we just have to kind of show them the way and make it a lot easier. You know, so it's, it's definitely true. Getting it closer to correct is always the goal.
How do you just touched on that how do you do, what's that balancing act between this is, we've discovered something new, this is cutting edge, this is going to change mountain biking, versus let's stay away from a whim, like, because it's, you know, it's, everyone wants this, but really, you know, it doesn't make any sense. So you don't want to miss out on a market opportunity, but it doesn't really make sense. It's not the best for your bike or your bike design. But there's got to be some kind of balancing act there, right?
You know, what's lucky about IBIS is that we're so small that we all have a voice, right? So I mentioned we do have like an all-women design team, but we do not design without our engineering counterparts, like 100%. Through the entire process, like, and because we manufacture in the US, like with one of our frames, we can actually go to the factory and see how our designs are affecting how they're being produced. So when we kind of like look into that more deeply and try to work together to make these products, like we're seeing like how to solve the problem without making more problems. So if we see something interesting, we're like, okay, let's qualify that, or let's buy it and try it ourselves. You know, like, I don't know of many trends that aren't vetted that we kind of jumped on. You know, like, I think there's always an opportunity, especially for, you know, components manufacturers, like they all want to differentiate from each other. So like they can come up with really nuanced settings, controls, and things like that. And so when I see something like on a bike that makes me take pause, I have to think like, is that pause because I'm questioning it and I'm worried about it? Or is it because I think it's like the next best thing in the world. And, you know, when we double check with each other, we'll share information. We're like, oh, what do you think about that? And then you'll get everyone's opinions about like what it's doing or like why it's not working or, you know, and there's really like by that time the consensus is made, it's like, huh, I think we might stay away from that one. Or like, oh, that looks so strange. Even if it worked right, I don't know if anyone would accept it.
Was gonna buy it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that was one of the challenges with all of our bicycles. Like, you know, you can make things look really cool and technically, you know, like still sound, but there's some designs that look so conceptual that people just won't touch it. You know, like people will be like, ooh, that's a little bit, you know, out there. And we see it all the time. We kind of want to normalize ourselves. Like, even if we want something amazing and beautiful, like we don't always want to stand out in every circumstance, you know? So I find it really interesting when you do something and you're like, that is super unique. It's patentable. You know, like, what do I do with this now? Or like, you're like, I'm going to hang out with that and like vet it out.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, you know what, Giant, we've had, you know, 22 years, we've had some wild designs, you know, over the years. And sometimes, like, it actually works really great. But to your point, it just looks a little off. And, you know, there's a product that comes to mind. We had a bike, my father-in-law, I live on a street with my father-in-law, he's 83, and he rides one of these bikes every single night for an hour on our street. It's just flat, you know, it just does ovals. Yeah. But the bike was called the Revive, and it was like a 20-inch wheel bike, and it had this really high handlebar. You could put the handlebar like literally right underneath your chin if you wanted to. It was like super adjustable, really weird. It was in the movie iRobot, and it's a goofy looking product, but it was really well thought out. Obviously all these years later, my father-in-law rides it, you know, it's the only bike he'll ride. He would never ride a conventional bike. He doesn't think they're comfortable. You know, it has like an office chair on it almost, like it's got a backrest and you know, like under an office chair, you have that little handle that you pull that lets it go up or down. It has that same thing, you know, it's really bizarre, but that was one of those cases where, and I remember when we launched it, I went to San Francisco at Justin Herman Plaza, and we set up a tent and we were out there demoing this thing. And I remember just trying to get people to ride it was like a hard thing, but then everybody would ride it and then they'd come back and go, wow, this thing's amazing, you know? And it was like a breakthrough in a way, but yeah, that was one of those.
But it never went anywhere.
It never really went anywhere. We made it for a couple of years and then it went away. But yeah, it's tricky. You know, sometimes it could be a great, it works great. Doesn't look right. That's not going to work. It's got to be all of them, right? Yeah.
Hey, on a side note, Mike, tonight, will you just take a video of your father-in-law going around? I've got to see this.
Exactly.
He has three
going
of them
in circles for an hour.
Oh my gosh. Geez.
He has three of the bikes because he'll see, like, I'm, you know, I'm the rep, so I'm driving around. I'll be like, hey, there's a guy over here who's got one, and he'll call him up and he'll just go get it because, you know, stuff goes bad on it. And he just likes to have extras. He's trying to get his gal into doing it. She won't ride it. Okay. So
Roxy, you mentioned something that really intrigued me. And I hope it's something that, you know, sticks and grows, but you said that you're actually manufacturing one of your bikes back here in the States.
Yeah. So that would be the XC USA frame. We're making that in Pajaro, California. It's about 25-minute drive from our main headquarters on the west side of Santa Cruz.
Okay.
So we've been making that frame for a few years, and our first one was just one small size of the Ripley SL original. We wanted to try it because it was just one of those like, oh, it's low production. We don't need a lot of quantities, and we can just try it and test it. So yeah, that's one of our models right now that we're making in-house. So it was a huge endeavor. I feel like, reshoring is one of those things that everyone loves the idea of doing, but the practicality of getting the fabric and making it in-house and having the manpower and the knowledge base. We're really lucky because we have that here in California, especially where we are. As you well know, Kestrel was here, and we actually had the person responsible for offshoring from Kestrel, Preston Sandusky. He was brought in to create our manufacturing here and led that up with the R&D. And so a lot of the people that used to lay up carbon, one of those guys is still with us now. So like he's got, 25 plus years in layup, information and knowledge. And so you need some of that support. You can't just like pop up a factory somewhere without the people that know how to kind of craft with that material. And so we're really lucky that we brought it back as soon as we did, because that means that we're creating something new and new processes. Whereas, right now the types of manufacturing overseas was, now it's, I would say it's based off of knowledge that was, I don't know, 20 years old. So how do you make things more efficient? How do you make things more energy neutral or saving energy? And how do you make it so that you can control the amount of waste and really focus production? Because like now we're really worried about our planet. It's a thing, like, and we're on the forefront because we live in Santa Cruz. We see the ocean, like there's something about like being on the edge of the continent that makes you really aware of, our impact on the planet. And so I think it's really one of those things now that is also changing in our industry. It's like, how can we be more proactive and actionable about what we're making?
Maybe that's a business opportunity. Get all the doubters and have them take tour buses down to Santa Cruz and see the impact that it, because it is, it is real, right? So,
How's the market responding? Obviously making, you have stuff that's made offshore, and then you have now you have this new product here made in the US. The cost of a product manufactured in the United States is going to be more expensive. You offer an XE and you offer the XE USA, right? So are you finding that your clients are responding to the USA product even at the additional cost or
Yeah, I think so the XE USA is manufactured a little bit differently than our offshore partners, because we don't paint the USA frames. We only decal and put like a layer of Cerakote to protect it. We have to have the finished quality coming out of the mold really high. That's not to say there isn't like a little blemish here or there, or but because we don't add paint, we don't add like the weight of paint. So primering, sanding, primering, sanding. So it is like the lightest weight bike we make, and it's really nice in that respect. And then for those who want to support, made in manufacturing in the US, it just takes a while to scale, and so when we see people respond well to the product, we're like, okay, this is viable. And for what it's worth, because we're manufacturing here, we can throttle up or back depending on demand. And so that's one of the things that's really efficient about it as well, because if you're manufacturing something overseas, there's like a minimum order quantity. You have to like, make sure you get this many, and it's always too much. It's always too much. So, because it's to scale. Like you can't make a factory go like, oh, we only want 100 of those. you know.
Yeah.
And so I think that is a responsible way to think about the product. And anyone who's already in that mindset of like, I feel responsible for things, I will pay more. We get those customers a lot. And then there's also the customers that are like, I value this, I see a future in it, but I can't hit that price point. Like, that's just not attainable. And,
yeah,
you know, it's okay. Like, we accept it. And that's why we tried it with a lower quantity in our world, product that isn't going to, like, you know, make us push too much for a lot of manufacturing of the units. We just want to make sure that we can, kind of test our theories and see what sticks. You know, mm-hmm. So it's a little like an R&D lab / manufacturing.
I should have brought this up earlier, but the advent of 3D printing, are you taking advantage of that? Does that make life easy in designing bikes so you could get something tested, see it?
So we do not 3D print anything that we ride test. We utilize 3D printing to vet out things that are like shape or sizing or cable routing, because of the flexibility in the materials. Like, we can produce some things that are like, you know, bash guards or, you know, chain guards or things like that. And I know that there are opportunities for 3D printing in like carbon to make frames, but we're not doing that.
Yeah, I would think more from a testing standpoint, right? So did...
Yeah, you know, we're pretty I guess like experienced and educated in the sensibility that like, if we're doing something with like a unidirectional weave, we know that if we 3D print, it's not going to have the same characteristics.
Okay. Right. Okay.
And, interesting. And we already know, like, if we lay it up in a certain pattern or angle weave, we're going to get this performance from it. So it's a little bit hard, because I feel like 3D printing, unless you're sort of doing it from like a 360 rotational axis, like, you're gonna get some layering, and for the most part, building up those objects, like, inherently it's not going to perform the same way as woven fabric, and so, not saying like, you know, 3D printing out of a material isn't going to be robust, but it's not the process that we're primarily interested in. So yeah,
I asked that. A friend of the family worked for a company that was 3D, trying to figure out how to build 3D printing to build rockets. And I kind of said, I don't want to be the astronaut that flies that.
You know, I've heard a rocket scientist actually say, you know, rockets just blow up. I mean, it's not like you have to blow up, reconfigure, and then make them come back. You know what I mean? It's like, there's rockets, and then there's like, you know, the shuttle. I don't want to be the person in the shuttle. Right. You know, maybe the rocket's fine. One thing that we are kind of dabbling in is VR space. For me, I'm really interested in that because, you know, as a designer, I always want to do things with my hands. And sometimes sitting behind a screen or like, you know, kind of with a mouse or something, you're a little far away. Like, even though it's right up close to you and you can zoom in, like, you don't get this perspective. So I think a little bit before COVID hit, I had bought an Oculus VR module and got into this software program. And now it's gotten to a point where you can like actually go in and like manipulate 3D drawings and sculptures, and then bring it back into engineering software and print out of that. And so I'm super excited about that, because it's a little bit like quirky putting something on your head, but I don't see it too far from the future where you're just like in this holographic setting where you're like, okay, I'm designing in space and it's right in front of me. But it's not like a clay model. It's not like a foam model. There's no like material that's used or wasted. You know, it's just like, you know, like pixels in space.
Yeah. Wow, that's wild. Yeah, we have an Oculus at our place, but the only thing we really do with it is run into walls and smack each other inadvertently. Yeah.
Yeah, you can get pretty excited in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to go
That's
back
funny.
to manufacturing in the US real quick. So are you able to get all of the materials? Because I know that's kind of one of the challenges. Like over in Taiwan, for example, right? In Deja, Taiwan, all the manufacturers of all the goods, it's all right there, right? It's where here in the United States, are you able to buy the raw carbon and the resin, or do you make your own resin, or how does all that
We
prevent
actually work
challenges like
with
that?
a supplier, and we get pre-impregnated carbon. So we already get the weave re already with the resin content
Got it.
integrated with that. Other companies might have the same kind of like getting the rolls. Some other people do it with like just the carbon fibers, and then they, you know, do the resin fill during the process of manufacturing. So there's quite a bit of variation in who's doing what. But basically we're all kind of doing the same thing and you know, kind of like fighting the aerospace and the airplane industry for raw
Yeah,
goods.
right. Yeah.
And actually, you know, like, and talent too, because there's so many like electric vehicle or vertical takeoff you know, planes now that everyone's making carbon fiber something. And so we're vying for the same employees, which
Yeah.
is like incredible.
Yeah, I know there has been some people that I know that have left the bike industry to work in aerospace. So a lot of those skills translate for sure. Dave actually had an employee of his who was a service manager when he ran the bike shop, and his dad, he had a bicycle wheel manufacturing company called Round Wheels. He sold that off, and then now he works for Boeing. So yeah, a lot of crossover in terms of talent. There seems to be more money in aerospace, darn it. So yeah, I would
Well,
think
now
the
there's just
bicycle
more
is way more
jobs in
important.
general.
Yeah, I always joke with them, the bicycle is way more important than aerospace. Come on, get back to the meaningful stuff. Come back to the bike business, you know. So but you can make a case either way for sure. Yeah. Well, it's
Hey,
exciting that you're building these bikes in the United States again. You know, that's a big deal. I know when Ibis was founded, they were building, granted much simpler bikes, but chromoly steel bikes were being made here domestically. And I was a retailer in the early days of Ibis. And I remember there was like a kid that was a trials rider, and he got on David Letterman. And I just remember, yeah, I remember he had like the Ibis jersey on. And I just remember thinking, I don't know how old, I mean, I wasn't very old. That had to be like in the 90s, maybe early 90s. And I just remember thinking, how cool is this? Ibis. Nobody knows what Ibis is in the real world, just us bicycle people. And here's this kid bouncing up and down on David Letterman's desk.
Yeah, it's
That
we have a
was so
photo of
cool.
that. It's great.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, it's in our history wall.
That was a big moment for people that, like I don't think like my parents' generation, I don't think they really saw the bicycle industry, or at least my parents didn't see it as a career path, and I've been in the industry now, I mean, pretty much my whole life, and it's been a great career path, and I'm so grateful for it. But when Andy was on that show, I remember like, how it impacted how my parents kind of looked at, wow, look at this guy on a bicycle, and he's on David Letterman,
Yeah,
and
maybe Mike's not such a loser.
Yeah, he was my hero. But
Yeah.
I still remember it. I remember bits and pieces of it, but That was a big deal. And at our bike shop, we sold, there was a bike that, I think they were made off. I think they were overseas made, but we had sold a couple of those bikes. And it had this really, nice, I think it was magnesium. It's like a cast magnesium bash guard on it or something, but some real innovative stuff. And,
I think that cool. That time of the industry, you know, everyone was like really playing with like technology, you know, and now I would be like, oh my gosh, what is that? But that's the joy of bicycles, right? Because like you can keep exploring and keep making things. And I feel like, you know, having someone like that jump onto David Letterman and bounce around on a bike really just is like representation of what you care about and showing others like this is a thing. And it's not just some obscure background, you know, feeling that you're having, and it's not a whim and it's not a like hobby. It's like a actual profession. And so I think that's like such a cool realization when someone actually like goes like, oh, I understand what you do now, you know, like, I understand why you like this.
Yeah. At the time, there was really nothing on TV relating to bicycles at all, you know? And so it was just really neat and validating anyway. So Ibis got it done.
Go on.
Go ahead, Dave. Sorry. Hey, cut you off.
I want to be sensitive to Roxy's time. I don't know how we're doing, but two things that I definitely want to cover. Like, is there the next big thing? Maybe you can't release it, but like, is there a next big thing in the industry or within Ibis that you're really excited about? Number one. And number two, I know you have a life outside of Ibis, and I know you do some trail advocacy. I'd love to hear about that as well. So,
First one is secret.
Come on, Dave.
I knew you were going to say that, but I had to ask, right?
Yeah.
You heard it first here on Cycle Jerks.
Yeah. I think that there's always going to be first. There's always going to be things that we want to kind of push and get out there. And, you know, honestly, it's so hard because, you know, my Instagram is like food and outdoors and my dog. I don't have any sketches on there. I don't have any, you know, like work related things. It's just like I work so far in the future that like sometimes it can change, like, you know, so like,
yeah,
you know. And it's frustrating too, because sometimes there's things that you're like, I want to follow through on this, or like I see it and then something totally changes in the industry. Like I remember when we were making something and, you know, like all of a sudden, like 26 inch wheels weren't a thing anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, we've jumped to 27.5 and 29. None of those other wheels count. And you're like, what? Like, oh my gosh. You know, like everyone did like a major turnaround in space. And so like I always like right now, because technology is integrated into cycling, I like I'm really careful to like not, you know, open up that can of worms yet, because things change so quickly. So that's what I'll say about that. For trail advocacy, you know, we work really closely with a group here in Santa Cruz called Santa Cruz Mountain Trails Stewardship. And we usually do like a yearly raffle with them for one of our bicycles, like win any one. And then we also have another smaller program for just the volunteers. So like if you volunteer, you get like a raffle ticket. And so you volunteering can get you a free bike. And that's just so special because we value that type of volunteering and just giving back to the community. It's really one of those things where it's like a lot of people are like, well, I'll just donate money, you know, and you're like, well, money isn't going to wake up, isn't going to dig that hole, isn't going to like carry all those tons of rocks up the hill to shore up the trail that we're using. But everyone benefits from it, you know? And so I feel really strongly that these groups that have popped up and are asking for help if you can't give monetarily, give with your time. And I love that about, you know, and Dave, you picked up on that pretty early on, but like, I'm all about sweat equity.
Yeah.
Like really giving back, because, you know, when you look at a lot of park systems, especially within the state of California and also, you know, fish and wildlife, there isn't a lot of people able to work and maintain and upkeep the trail systems. I live in Bonnie Dune, really special place, but like every single outdoor network that I belong to, like we have to do the trail maintenance ourselves because of the lack of volunteers or paid workers that can possibly do this. I think it's really important to live and breathe in the outdoors. And if we're in the cycling industry, like advocacy is the only way we can maintain having outdoor space to recreate in.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, awesome. It's so much more personal when you go out there and put that sweat equity in it versus just cutting a check for, you know, you cut a check and you, you know, but you're not really connected to the people that are doing the work and what the whole movement. It's a level of disconnect that comes up. Now the money's appreciated for sure, but getting out there with the people and working on the trail, that's where the connections are made and the, you know, the good vibes. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, like we all have, like, there's a certain type of time of year where, you know, it gets kind of challenging to ride around here, and you're still outdoors, you're still smelling the earth, you know, like you're getting your hands dirty in something, and you're super proud of like the trail that you just made. When you're done with it, you're like, I did that. Like every single time, it probably drives my friends crazy, but I'm like, I did that. That was me moving a ton of rocks that one time.
Yeah. Well, anybody that's been to Santa Cruz knows that they have a fantastic trail system. And yeah, it's like I said at the beginning, it's really one of the premium destinations. And I know, you know, a lot of people will, like, I know riders from Canada that will come to Santa Cruz to ride when it's, they can't ride up there, you know, and it's become a real premium destination for mountain biking, and the road riding is pretty fantastic too. And I know you do a little bit of gravel as well.
Yeah, I found a trail that takes me from my house up the road over to a little basin, down to Big Basin, back on Highway 1, and then back up around. And it's just like, I did it like slowly because I didn't have a map that connected everything. And so, yeah, I'm all about exploring. I really do enjoy, like riding off road. It's a little hard on the spine a little bit, but I do appreciate the lightness and the speed, and just like, you know, I really enjoy having the freedom, to ride. And you know, you're self-sufficient when you're riding that kind of road and gravel and off-road. I just feel very free doing it. Like I'm not trapped to any particular terrain, I guess. Yeah. That's the fun part.
I think you nailed it. That is the intrigue of the gravel bike, right? It's just you're going anywhere, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
yeah, it's funny because you could certainly do it on a mountain bike. I was trying to explain it to somebody and they were saying, well, you could totally do that on your mountain bike. I go, yeah, but I don't do it on my mountain bike. I get on the gravel bike, and then it encourages you to explore and expand I think on the mountain bike, you know, it's different for everybody, but sometimes you get into the adrenaline of it and you gotta get into this trail because it's so fun. And, you know, maybe you're missing three other trails that are really fun. In a different way, because you're looking for a specific type of fun on a mountain bike. But yeah, definitely there's great gravel out there too, for sure. Well, listen, Roxy, it's been really enlightening having you on the show. And Dave, I feel like we should wrap it up, being respectful to Roxy's time. She has a job to do. I know you don't, but
I don't. So if you guys want to hang out for a while, I'm totally good with it. I just a little bathroom break and another Diet Pepsi, and I'm good for another hour.
Too much information.
I'm sorry. I do want to say this though, and this is not, they will say, some people have said that the list of asses I've kissed is long but distinguished, but I do want to say, whatever you're doing, Roxy, keep doing what you're doing, because I'm going to admit I'm a roadie and a gravel guy, and very rarely am I on my mountain bike. But I will tell you that when I had my shop, we were very fortunate enough to be an Ibis dealer. One of my friends and customers, most loyal customers, is actually brother-in-law to Tom Morgan. Mm. And so we got connected to Ibis. And if ever you need customer testimonials from the customers that bought the Ibis, just let me know, because they were just such loyalists to the bikes. And I will also say too, I think it probably speaks to the culture there too. I don't know if he's still there, but Josh was our main contact. And, unlike Mike at Giant, we got really good support from Josh.
Well, Josh came from, the sales space,
That's right,
so yeah.
Was he Hank and Frank?
He was.
Yeah.
I worked with Josh at Hank and Frank for years, and when he got the job at Ibis, I was so happy for him, because I just knew it was going to be the perfect spot for him, and he's one of the special guys, special relationships that I've had with shop guys over the years.
I joke about Mike, obviously, but and I do applaud the support that we got. But again, I think it more is the bikes, I could go on and on about the day we had a demo day, and it was like a cult following. People came from all over the place to just to ride these bikes and what they would say about them. And it was just, so keep doing what you're doing, because you're nailing it.
Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to give a shout out to our designers, Lily Heim again, and Kat Giuseppe, and our engineers, Andy Jacquemain and Colin Hughes. We are a team. We work together really tightly with Hans and Tom to create things and to make them really viable. Everyone in the organization has a say, and I think that's what makes, at the end of the day, such a good brand, is that we just listen to everyone, and everyone has an opinion. And so feel free to send those customer testimonials my way anyway, because we periodically will send some of those out, especially when we have a launch of a bike, and the pink bike reviews and the posts are so horrible that we're combat that with some goodness,
Yeah.
I have to say, the pink bike comments are pretty fun, but I could relate, as at the Giant rep, you can imagine, right? So we get some, it's just funny to me after a while. It does hurt a little bit, but you got to kind of take it with a grain of salt, probably some 13-year-old boy, just.
Or a 13-year-old mentality, forever.
Yes, yeah, there you go. I think you just nailed
that's
it.
That's more right.
Yeah. That's it. Bingo.
Awesome. Awesome. All
well,
right.
Thank you, Dave and Mike, so much for your podcast. I was listening to a few of them this weekend, during the weekend. And I really commend you for having such a breadth of people on your show, and just really telling the tale of the nuances of bike. So I really applaud you guys for sticking the course and doing it, and just being available and having the content available. It's really special. And I really appreciate meeting you through Lori Lee Lounge. So
Well, thank you for that. Yeah,
that was awesome. You made my day. Thank you.
But there's so many great people in this business, and it's so fun to shine a light on them. In some cases, it's people that we know. In other cases, it's people we just met. But there's so many fantastic people and stories, and it's just great to be able to share them with everybody. So, we appreciate you being on and being part of that. Thank you so much, Roxy, for joining us. And that's going to do it for this episode.
Number 135.
Woo-hoo! Yeah. Thank you very much, all.
Thank all you. Right.
Peace. We'll see.
If you like what we're doing here at Cyclejerks Podcast and you would like to support us, please check out our website at cyclejerkspodcast.buzzsprout.com. Hit the subscribe button. we shout out all subscribers. So get on it. Another way you can support the podcast would be by giving us a 5-star review on whatever streaming platform that you're listening on. We appreciate you. Thanks so much.
Cycle Jerks.
Hey, get out of the road, dummy.
Cycle Jerks Podcast.